This episode of Armchair Explorer is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With seven drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. And epic journeys is what we're all about. Learn more at nissanusa.com.
The fascination of any place is in the contradictions, the ambiguities, and what lives between the lines. But as soon as you're in a place, you begin to see this weave of subtleties and nuances, really explodes all your assumptions and all your explanations, and reminds you you're in this human place that can't be reduced to any simple sentence.
Today we're speaking with one of travel writing's true greats, the absolutely legendary Pico Iyer. He's written 15 books over the last 40-something years of globetrotting, covering everything from the Cuban Revolution to Islamic mysticism. He's also the official biographer of the Dalai Lama. How cool is that? And he's traveled with him extensively for many years. More on that later. I think you're going to like this one. Are you ready? Let's go. Welcome to Armchair Explorer, where the world's greatest adventurers tell their best stories from the road. My name's Aaron Miller, I'm a travel writer, and I'm pretty psyched about today because Pico is one of my travel writing heroes. I love how he weaves deeper social and philosophical themes into these incredibly vivid descriptions of place and the people he meets along the way. If you listen to this show regularly, you definitely know that that is my kind of thing. When I grow up, I want to become a proper travel writer, just like Pico. He also just has really cool ideas for stories, and this one is no exception. In many ways, this episode is about his life as a traveler and a writer, and he's going to take us around the world from North Korea to Northern India and beyond. He's looking for something that we all seek as travelers, but also just as human beings. That elusive place, somewhere, surely, just around the corner, or maybe on the other side of the world. He's looking for paradise, whatever that means, and wherever that may be. The book of his journey is called The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. It's beautiful. Get your hands on it. You won't be disappointed. And if you enjoy this episode, make sure you check out some of Pico's other books. You can find out all about that at picoirjourneys.com. His Twitter is at picoir. And while you're at it, follow me too. I'm on Instagram and Facebook at Armchair Explorer Podcast, which reminds me, shout out to Chris McCaffrey, who got in touch to say he's been listening to the show while on a round-the-world bike ride. How cool is that? He's somewhere in Malaysia right now, I think, just about to embark on his final leg across Australia. The show, he says, has been helping to remind him to savor the experience that he's having, despite it being difficult sometimes. He spent 8 months on the road, a lot of that on his own, and that's not easy. Well, guess what, Chris? You're not alone, mate. We're here too. So drop him a line, guys, and say hi at Chris in the Cold. Thank you for getting in touch, Chris. You're a legend. Keep pedaling. You're almost there. So if you're up to something cool or you're just dreaming about your next trip, come and hang out. Drop me a line. We're going to get on well. But don't worry about that right now, because the journey is about to begin.
So when I left high school at 17, I got into a little bus in Tijuana, and I bumped for 3 months all the way through Central America down to La Paz in Bolivia, and then traveled up the east coast of South America and back through the Caribbean to Miami, and then took a Greyhound bus back to California. And because I'd spent, you know, 10 years in a boarding school before that, everything was so wondrous and rich and remarkable to me, the jungles of Central America, traveling day after day at 15,000 feet in the Andes, surrounded by nothing but llamas and snow, and then arriving at the city named for peace 2.5 miles above the ocean, that I actually started keeping a diary, which I'd never done before in my life or considered doing, just because there was so much happening each day I wanted to keep with me forever. And I think probably after that 18-year-old trip, I thought to myself, if I'm going to all the trouble of keeping a diary, I could share this diary with friends and maybe even inflict it on strangers. And that's when the notion of traveling for a living came to mind as soon as I left high school. And I think what I quickly learned that I love about travel is that suddenly all the settings in your senses are turned on and you're wide awake, as I'm not the rest of the time, and everything becomes interesting. And you can even bring that sensibility to going across town wherever you happen to live.
Home, Pico says, is not just the place where you're born. It's the place where you become yourself. That's because for Pico, travel is all about transformation. The moments when we wake up and all our senses are turned on are the moments that change us. And perhaps that's where this idea we have of paradise comes from. If we could just find that place, the place would do all the work. It would seep into us. All our troubles would melt away. We would become ourselves, and paradise would become our home.
The pandemic gave me a chance to sit still for a long, long time, as I wouldn't otherwise, and to look back on 40 years of travel and to think about where the real moments of light and inspiration had come. And I think during the pandemic, when there was so much grief and uncertainty across the world, all of us were thinking, where can we find hope? Where is our sense of possibility? And the loss that was experienced everywhere was not incompatible with joy in the moment. And so I was with my 89-year-old mother as she was going through the last year of her life in her home in California. And I was thinking back on the travels I'd taken and thinking about how and where I could find paradise, and realizing that I only would trust a paradise I could find in the middle of the real world that existed in the thick of life and in the face of death. I've been to lots of places that feature on those beautiful travel agents' posters as paradises, Tahiti or the Maldives or Bali, but they're not paradise for the people who live there. And even for us, when we go there, we find ourselves on a golden beach in a beautiful day, and it seems like heaven on earth. And 6 hours later, the darkness falls and we hear the gamelan orchestras and we realize that the beach is probably going to be a lot more crowded tomorrow. And it's not necessarily a paradise that is going to last.
So he went looking in the hardest places to find it, the places that would never feature on a travel agent poster. I figured if I could find a paradise in the middle of Jerusalem or Varanasi or Kashmir, he says, maybe that would be a paradise that could really survive everything. So he begins, fittingly, in a place at the center of competing visions of paradise, one of the most misunderstood and half-known places in the world.
After 50 years of constant travel, Iran is without question the richest, most sophisticated, and most surprising, most unexpected place I've ever visited. And the one place I would tell all my friends to visit, especially my friends in the US, precisely because everything we know about it speaks to only its government or a tiny section of its populace and not to this remarkably old and diverse culture. I start the book in Iran in part because that's where the word paradise actually comes from, and in part because what's so interesting about Iran today is that, of course, the ruling clerics have one notion of a paradise, which is almost reserved for martyrs. And the regular people in Iran often have their own sense of paradise, which is kind of sex and drugs and rock and roll behind closed doors. So it's a wonderful convergence of different visions of paradise. It seemed like a good way to begin a book called The Half-Known Life, because I'd been studying and reading up on and writing about Iran for 30 years, though I'd never been. So by the time I finally did arrive, I thought, I know this place pretty well. I've been reading up on it for 30 years. And within 4 hours, I saw I didn't know a thing.
He arrived at 2:25 in the morning at the northern city of Mashhad. The man who picked him up from the airport was dressed in fine black slacks and spoke better English than he did, he says, pointing out passers-by who looked like John Cleese or Mr. Bean as they drove through the crowded streets. His hotel had the Beatles Yesterday playing in the lobby, and a mosque next to a shop selling Swarovski crystals and Parisian beauty products. CNN was on the TV. The internet was faster than it was in California, where he'd just flown in from. It was nothing like the Iran he'd been dreaming about for 30 years.
It was my very first night in Iran, and having spent the day with my guide and my driver, I thought, I really want to see the place unchaperoned. I sent them off to dinner. I stole down to the lobby of the hotel, to the taxi desk, and I asked them if they could find me somebody to take me into the center of town. And very quickly, a very friendly guy, about 30 years old, speaking unexpectedly good English, showed up, and he led me out to his battered compact, and we took off into the dark. And unbeknownst to me, I'd arrived at the most important week of the year in Mashhad, because it was the birthday of the saint buried at the center of the shrine. And so all the streets were full of fairy lights. And 5 million pilgrims had come from every corner of the Shia world to be there. And when we arrived at the shrine, which happens to be the largest mosque in the world, 7 extraordinary marble courtyards, we could hardly move. Everywhere there were people seated on the ground, sipping tea, sharing sweetmeats, stretched out to sleep because they were spending 7 days and 7 nights there. And they were surrounded by these huge video screens on which black turbaned ayatollahs were delivering sermons. It's really a remarkable scene. We could barely walk, but finally we came to the innermost sanctum, and my driver looked over at me, and I think he could tell I was very sincere. I'd really saved up all my money to come and learn about his culture. So he invited me into the innermost sanctum where the saint has been buried for 1,200 years. A very small space, really jam-packed, and we quickly got separated.
The Imam Reza Shrine is believed to cure sickness and sorrow in every pilgrim who visits. I was humbled as I moved among the sobbing bodies, he writes. Men were running their hands down their faces and weeping as at their mother's funeral. Little boys were being passed from shoulder to shoulder so they could arrive at the front to kiss the golden grill behind which lay the saint. A man wailed, and a great sound rose up around us. More than 30 million pieces of silver on the walls and chandeliers turned us all into a shiver of reflections.
And at one point I looked across the room and I saw my driver, and his hand was on his heart, and he was walking backwards so he would never present his back to the long dead saint. And there were tears welling in his eyes. He just seemed like the picture of Islamic piety. But 10 minutes later, when we were back out on the street walking towards his car again, he told me about his wife, who he said was a Yorkshire woman who was waiting for him in England and expecting their first baby. And then he told me that he had paid a human trafficker $2,500 to smuggle him into England in the back of a truck, breathing through a tube so he wouldn't be detected. And then he told me how the British government had very generously given him a court-appointed lawyer and translator, and they had worked for 3 years to win him asylum status in Britain. And yet, every summer, he stole back into the country he'd stolen out of, Iran, to see the mother and the hometown and the mosque that he missed so much. And so, when he dropped me off at my hotel, and again, this was 20 hours after I'd arrived in Iran, my very first night, I thought, Iran is in our front pages every day, pretty much, for the last many years. And I'd never heard about a dissident stealing back into the country he's risked his life to steal out of. And I'd never heard about a very faithful Islamic soul who didn't want to live in an Islamic republic. And I think it just reminded me of what all travel is about, which is the fascination of any place is in the contradictions, the ambiguities, and what lives between the lines, which is really exactly what you almost never get if you just watch CNN or read the New York Times. But as soon as you're in a place, you begin to see this weave of subtleties and nuances that really explodes all your assumptions and all your explanations and reminds you you're in this human place that can't be reduced to any simple sentence.
He'd known before he arrived that Iran would be a paradise of complications, as he puts it, but it was even more nuanced than he'd expected. Weeping, fervent displays of religious faith by people who wanted no parts of religious rule. People stealing out of a country for one version of paradise and stealing back in every year for the one they left behind. Modern Iran is a battleground of competing ideologies played out on a societal and personal scale. Yet perhaps most tellingly of all, he notes, both sides, progressive and dogmatic, quote the same poets and see the beauty in the same lines. But it made him think, if paradise can't be reduced to a single idea, if it is just too personal and nuanced, is a collective paradise even possible? To try and answer that, he traveled to the so-called people's paradise of North Korea, where, he writes, people seemed a little beside the point and perfection was seen simply as the ruthless elimination of every last imperfection.
I've got to admit, it's the only place I've been where you really, even when you're there, you don't travel very much behind the two-dimensional facade, because they only show you what they want you to see, which is this showcase capital of Pyongyang and a few other showpiece places. And so it looks like a stage set to some degree. And of course, so much of North Korea is in desperate starvation and poverty, and those are all the places that no visitor is allowed to see. But it's an unsettling place. Every time you go there, they take you on a ride in the subway system in Pyongyang. So you descend these huge escalators to these remarkable showpiece subway stations that are all golden statues and dazzling murals. And a train pulls up and you get in. And after about 2 minutes, a local will come up to you and say in perfect English, "Greetings, we really hope you're enjoying your time in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea." And you realize it's an actor. It's somebody who's been forced by the government to act as a local and to make a good impression on the occasional foreigner. But even that thought, that everybody you're meeting is to some extent an actor, you know, is a provoking one and an interesting one and a humbling one. Every day, all through the main streets, on loudspeakers at 6 a.m. was blasted this recording. We live in the greatest paradise on earth and Kim Il-sung is the greatest human. Every day for the rest of their lives, they were going to hear that as they woke up. And all the TVs were fixed, so there was only one channel. And it was telling them too, we are living in the greatest paradise on earth. And of course, the totalitarian government relies on the fact that their citizens know nothing about the rest of the world, and they think this is how humans always live. And actually, this is a pretty well-ordered society. So literally, I think almost anybody I met wouldn't even know what the rest of the world looks like. And it really made me skeptical about the notion of a collective paradise, because every one of us has a different notion of an ideal world. So one that's imposed from without, which is true of intentional communities or communist societies or so many different societies, is never going to work. And I think the only paradise that we can trust has to be democratic, but has to be an individual one.
He went to North Korea because he wanted to believe that even here, humanity could not be totally suppressed, that it would at some point, as he puts it, peek out from behind the gates of ideology. And he did, on his last visit, find some of those glimmers. A Chanel hair clip on his guide, questions about Apple computers. One person in his entourage knew the song Let It Go from Frozen. But perhaps those were all stage managed too, he wondered. Probably, or at least reserved for a privileged few. But we'll never know. This paradise has iron walls to keep it from falling down. They're easy to see. But there are other kinds of walls, and all too often, they are obscured from our view.
And of course, the tragedy of Jerusalem is some variation on that conflict has been taking place for 2,500 years. Sadly, it's not new. And it arises because one person's notion of paradise is not his neighbor's and never will be. But even though we know all about this before we arrive in Jerusalem, it's still startling to arrive in a place where the center of three great monotheisms are separated by only 600 meters, and where, when you go into really one of the most important sites in Christendom, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you find that there are six Christian orders who sleep under the same roof, and they're constantly at odds with one another. If the Greek Orthodox priests step 2 inches into the Franciscan area, they start going after one another with brooms. So even within the same religion, one reading of the holy text is very different from another. And in that sense, Jerusalem is a very sobering place because our notions of paradise will never converge, even if we're following the same religious teacher and working from the same religious texts. But on another level, Jerusalem is unimaginably magnetic.
This episode of Armchair Explorer is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. And Pathfinder, that's a pretty cool name, isn't it? Because that's also what this show is all about. Exploring, getting off trail, having adventures, finding your own path, and living life to the fullest. Sound like you? Yep, sounds like me too. Which is why I'm so excited to partner with Nissan. The 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has 7 drive modes, available intelligent 4x4. It's got the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds. So go ahead and bring all that gear with you and lots more. The 2024 Nissan Pathfinder, a vehicle built for adventures everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at nissanusa.com. Pico has visited Jerusalem numerous times. He's not Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, but he says nonetheless that he still feels its pull, and in particular to one place within it.
When I'm staying there, I usually stay in a little hospice in the old city, and I'll wake up before dawn and I'll walk across the uneven cobblestones towards the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And I sit in a little cave in one corner of that huge space. And there's nothing there except a ragged ledge and a single tiny flickering candle. And I couldn't tell you why, but something about me so moves me about sitting there, I'm reduced almost to tears. And it may be just the 1,700 years of prayer and worship and devotion that have been brought to that for that single site. And so Jerusalem speaks for the beauty of something almost tangibly sacred and divine that's everywhere you look, and the mess that we humans can make of that. We humans want to cut our notion of heaven up into many different bases and fight over what is the real heaven, at the same time as there is this spellbinding power that's in the stones and in the air there that nothing has managed to efface. And it's really heartrending what is taking place in Gaza currently. But Jerusalem, at some level, has both entertained that conflict forever and survived that conflict forever. And my guess is that if you or I were to step into Jerusalem next year, for all the political agony and for all the insoluble tragedy of that place, we would still feel deeply moved by something we couldn't explain.
Jerusalem, I was coming to think, he writes, was the place where everyday morality and religion part ways on the grounds of irreconcilable differences. It is a city, he says, made up only of inner lives, always in full throat. And the question at the heart of everyone was as simple as it was unanswerable. How to make peace and passion rhyme. But perhaps there is an answer, and it's so obvious, and he found it outside the Basilica of the Agony, not far away. Please, the sign says, no explanations inside the church. Pico's journey takes us from the streets of Belfast to the flaming ghats of Varanasi. We drift on heavenly boats in Kashmir, surrounded by the scars of hell. We meet Aboriginals in Australia and climb holy mountains in Sri Lanka. But our journey ends in a place steeped in the romanticism of paradise on earth. Shangri-La is a fictional place, first mentioned in James Hilton's famous novel Lost Horizons, a utopia hidden from the world deep in the Himalayas. Many places have since laid claim to being its inspiration, but perhaps the most enduring is indeed hidden in the highest mountains on earth, in a place called Ladakh in northern India.
The reality I experienced was wondrous. It really feels, it feels at peace and happy, able to take in some visitors from the world, but still to go about its ways unimpeded. People, I think, have been sustaining their Buddhist and Himalayan traditions unchanged for centuries there. As you're driving through Ladakh, every time you turn a corner, there is some impossible temple teetering on top of a cliff, looking as if it will fall off, but it's been there for 400 years. Buddhist monks everywhere. It's a wonderful place.
One day, walking away from the center of Leh, the town where he stayed, he found himself, he writes, on a shaded rustic lane where villagers who looked as their great-grandparents might have done were making their slow, reverent way to the nearest temple. A group of musicians sat on the ground among the poplars, serenading a traditional archery competition. Villagers were singing as they worked. It's hard to read that and not think that this is some kind of paradise.
And therefore, it asks me the question that if it is Shangri-La, what am I doing there? The only thing I can bring to such a pure and self-contained place is corruption. And if it really is going its happy way, unimpeded by visitors, maybe I shouldn't be visiting at all. So it's a place that I really only have positive things to say about, but therefore I have to ask questions about what I can bring, because if a place seems relatively perfect, all I can bring to it is imperfection.
When we think of paradise, we think, what can it do for me? But perhaps we should also think, what can I do for it? And that's exactly why every year his old friend, the Dalai Lama, comes here. As perfect as Ladakh may seem, Indian, Chinese, and Pakistani troops face off against each other nearby. Srinagar, the fraught Kashmiri capital, is only 150 miles away. And many young people Pico speaks with dream of elsewhere as much as we do. The Dalai Lama comes to remind people that even here, Shangri-La exists only in the imagination.
It's striking that when you hear him speak, he almost never speaks about nirvana or heaven, or he only speaks about what we can do right now to help those around us and our neighbors. And because every time for 10 years when he came to Japan, my wife and I traveled with him every minute of his working day, day after day after day. And so every evening he would give a public address. And almost every time, at the end, somebody would stand up and say very sincerely, Your Holiness, what do you do if you really want to reverse climate change or want to bring peace to the world or want to end the conflict in the Middle East, but it doesn't happen? And he looks at that person with great kindness, like an uncle, and he says, wrong dream. If your dreams are too great, you're always going to be frustrated. You've condemned yourself to disappointment. You have to make your dreams manageable and, you know, maybe try to bring peace to your family, to your household, rather than trying to bring it to the whole of the Middle East, let alone the whole planet. And I always translated to myself as saying, you know, if you dream of marrying Brad Pitt, it ain't going to happen. But if you dream of finding in your partner qualities that Brad Pitt would envy, that can happen right now. But you have to be very precise on how you fashion your dreams, how you fashion your visions of paradise. Otherwise, you're always going to fall short. And so his great sentence that I cite in the book is, wrong dream. He says that over and over and over again, faced with people's very unrealistic dreams. And if I were to describe the Dalai Lama in one noun, it would be realist. So he has no interest in wishy-washy or romantic or abstract notions. And one time I was sitting in on the private audience he was having with a Korean gentleman, and the Korean gentleman was so excited to see the Dalai Lama. He said at one moment, you are in the Pure Land, you belong in heaven. And the Dalai Lama said to him, I don't want to be in heaven. I want to be where I can serve. I want to be where I can offer things to other people. This is where I have to be, the fallen world. Heaven is the place where, you know, I'm in the refrigerator. I need to be in an imperfect place where maybe I can help other people. The other part of this equation is that if I think about all the people I've met, I think the one who has suffered the most in life is, in fact, the Dalai Lama. You know, he's been cast out of his homeland for 65 years now. He's seen his brothers, his mother, his tutor die. He's referred to by the government of almost the largest nation on earth as an evil spirit. And yet, as you know, all he's famous for is his constant smile and his infectious laugh and his robust confidence. So I include him in the book because he's an ideal illustration of the fact that even in very difficult circumstances, leading a life of suffering and incredible pressure, he has cultivated this peace of mind whereby it feels as if he's moving in a beautiful place. I'm not sure if I would call it, or if he would call it, paradise, but certainly whatever he's having, most of us wish we were having. And that's the kind of peace and selflessness that many of us would want to have in our lives.
For the Dalai Lama, true paradise must be grounded not in the fantasy of what may lie around the corner, but in the reality of what is here and now. It must be a paradise for all people, not hidden in a magic valley or lounging on a beach in Tahiti. But even more than that, what Pico realized after all those years of wandering is that searching for paradise is the wrong dream.
If I go to one of the temples down the road from where I'm sitting here in Kyoto, Japan, as you enter the temple, on the ground is written in Japanese the sentence, look beneath your feet. In other words, paradise isn't on the other side of the world. It isn't in the never-never future. It isn't in the past. The only place you can find it is right here, right now. And I remember one time, and this isn't in the book, but I was standing on the banks of the Ganges in Varanasi, which, as you know, is this crazy, chaotic place with dead bodies floating past and flames to the north and south where bodies are constantly being burned. And even though I'm Indian by birth and 100% Hindu by birth, I was totally freaked out by just the clamor of this scene. And suddenly two Tibetan monks appeared, one Tibetan and one American. And the American monk surveyed this scene of dead bodies and chaos and swarming crowds. He said, isn't this amazing? This is wonderful. This is life and death and everything in it. This is the only paradise we can exult in. And so it was a bracing reminder to me that the only paradise any of us can find has to be in this moment. I go to fairly hellish places in many respects because I think even in the middle of conflict and turmoil, there are always places of beauty, places of wonder. And sometimes that may be all that we're likely to get in life. In other words, I think life is always going to be difficult, but that difficulty doesn't preclude those many moments or maybe the whole lifetime of finding something that really inspires or sustains you. I suppose when I write about my travel, I want to take myself and take the reader past some of the simple assumptions we have into a much more complex reality. And it's in the midst of that complex reality we can find our paradise.
But it's not easy. And that is the paradox of this journey. In searching for paradise, we've already missed it. But if we don't search, if we don't question, if we don't try and peek behind the gates of ideologies that are sold and sermoned to us, then we'll never know if we've found it. We'll never know if we've truly become our best selves and found our home. That is the half-known life.
It's our notions of paradise and our images of paradise that get in the way of our seeing it. In this age of information, we actually know less about the world than ever before because we're getting it in two dimensions on screen. And so we're constantly hearing about Iran or Cuba or North Korea, but we know less than ever about daily life and regular folks there. And they know less than ever about our daily life, very likely. And at a deeper level, the older I get, the more I find that the really important moments in life are ones we can never begin to explain. You suddenly fall in love. A pandemic suddenly shuts down the world. Your house suddenly burns down and you lose everything you ever had, which happened to me. Or you step onto a terrace outside the Potala Palace in Lhasa and you feel lifted out of the world and the self that you know. And in some ways, it's those moments that we can't explain that the only things that we trust. And I think what I know at this point in life is very, very tiny. And it's surrounded by this wonderful, vast darkness of what I will never know. And I think the beauty of travel is that you find what you never thought to look for. And, you know, I think for me, this came home in every sense during the pandemic, when all of us couldn't travel the way we normally would. And so every morning with my wife, I just take a walk up the road. And it was usually just as the sun was coming up over the mountains. And some parts of the mountains were bathed in golden light and others were still buried in thick fog. And we would turn around and we'd see the Pacific Ocean scintillant in the distance with the islands so sharp you could almost count the ridges in their hills. And I would say, my goodness, this is as beautiful as anything. I would travel across the world to Cape Town and Rio de Janeiro to see, here it is, literally in my backyard, 15 minutes from my family home. And yet my parents have lived on that property for more than 50 years, and I'd never walked to the end of the road, 20 minutes away. And suddenly I'm realizing this is paradise in my backyard, even as I've been traveling to Lhasa and Kyoto and Rio de Janeiro to try to find it. Expectation is one of the worst things to take on any trip because expectation always defeats itself. If you're going in search of finding a paradise, you've almost defeated the impulse before you set off. But the images we have of paradise act like kind of blinders so that we don't see what's around us. And every now and then circumstance pulls those blinders off, as during the pandemic, and you realize I don't need to get on a plane or even get in a car. Everything I could want in terms of beauty and peace and radiance is right here.
Thank you so much, Pico. It's such an honor to have you on the show and hear you share your travels and wisdom with us. I really appreciate it. It's been an absolute treat to have you on. Once again, his latest book is called The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. There's so much more depth and so many more stories than we could have ever covered today. If you enjoyed the episode, I highly recommend you check that out. And his other books too, which you can find out about at picoourjourneys.com. And if you did enjoy the episode, a great way to say thanks is by spreading the word. Leave a review, maybe post about it if you think it'll inspire some of your friends or whatever works for you. Thank you. It really does mean the world to me. So until next time, keep searching for paradise. But remember, you don't have to look far because the more we look for wonder in the world, the more the wonder of the world becomes a part of who we are. Dare to be truly alive. This episode was produced by Armchair Productions. Find our other shows at armchair-productions.com. Armchair Explorer is a part of APT Podcast Studios. Jenny Allison did the guest booking and assisted in writing the episode. Charles Tyree did the audio editing and sound design. Our theme music was written by the artist Sweet Chap. And I'm Aaron Miller. I write and produce the show. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.